This is the true story of a New York City boy with big town hopes and small neighborhood dreams of becoming BFFs with the Real Housewives and other Bravo celebrities. Then, one day, that dream actually came true. Let me take you behind the velvet rope. Stay tuned for part two of our sit down with Peaches Christ. We're about to discuss showgirls, reality TV, Madonna. We got a lot to talk about. But if you haven't heard part one, take a listen. We talk about all of Peaches' inspirations, like John Waters, RuPaul, that time that RuPaul basically announced that she was working on Drag Race at one of Peaches' Midnight Mass events. All the background you need is in part one. You could listen to part two without listening to part one, but wouldn't that make much more sense if you listen to part one first of our sit down with Peaches Christ? I don't know. I think so. And now part two.
Yeah, it's still bizarre to me. And I definitely have benefited from the success of it. You know, certainly having friends, Some of the queens I knew before they went on the show, like Bob, Bob was actually in one of my shows before, you know, Bob went on Drag Race, and I knew Bianca. Bianca, in many ways, is more of a peer to myself and Varla, Coco, Jackie, because we all knew Bianca Del Rio. Bianca was, you know, Bianca's only a year younger than I am. So we all grew up together. And I would say Bianca is the only one of the sort of quote unquote legends besides Chad Michaels, but you know, who we were familiar with that went on the show. And, you know, she was Bianca Del Rio that people knew. And now she's Bianca Del Rio who sells out, you know, Wembley and has 2.3 million followers on Instagram. Like it is surreal. It's bizarre. But Bianca herself has not changed. Like, you know,
right.
She's doing the same stuff she did then. It's just, you know, it's just been exposed to a much bigger audience.
Well, I live in New York City, so I was going to the Intermezzo brunch with Miss Bianca Del Rio back. But when she got Drag Race, there was this buzz around New York of like she won. I mean, it wasn't like out there, it was like episode one, and all around New York City, people were like, no, she actually wins the season. So I don't know if that was just like, because she's great or something, but like, it was like, oh no, Bianca's gonna win. So yeah, it's a little strange, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's surreal. And Ben De La Creme I worked with before she went on Drag Race. So Jinx I knew before she went on Drag Race. So I have to say I'm friends with a lot of winners.
You're just realizing this, right?
Yeah.
And we've had a lot of them on this show. We had Lady Bunny on, like, so yeah, I mean, it's you've seen it's like benefited your career in a sense that like you're working with them and they draw.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of the big question is why haven't, you know, more of us gone on Drag Race or auditioned? Right. And I will be totally honest and say that I completely struggled with that and, you know, decided that for me, and not to say that I definitely would have gone on, you know, but I, you know, didn't ever audition. And for me, I'm really like, I would love to have that sort of level of money and stuff. I mean, that's really lovely, but I don't think I would have succeeded in that format, right? Like it's a very specific thing. My success is being a producer, writer, director. You know, I'd be better off working on Drag Race behind the scenes than in front of the camera. I'm not competitive at all, but getting to produce and write and direct for people who have those audiences has certainly benefited my career. You know, my biggest fear is I'd go on that show and be kicked off, you know, second because I don't know how to sew or whatever. At least I'm realistic about it, you know.
Yes. Yes and yes. What about like, so you never really, I mean, you thought of it, but you never really thought of it.
No, I did. I mean, I think that any of us, I know I've talked with Varla and Coco about it a lot. Yeah, I mean, I think there was this window where it would have been smart for us to have tried it. The window around when Bianca went on. Like, I think Varla would be so good on that show. I think she would be so great because she's this hunky muscle man, you know, that people, like, gay twinks would just love because she's a total daddy, like a muscle daddy.
Yeah.
But then she becomes this femme Varla Jean Merman, and she's completely flexible and malleable and can do, like, anything. Whereas Coco and Peaches Christ tend to be more defined, and our skill sets are... You know, like, it would be strange to see Coco have to do all those different challenges, right? Certainly a queen like Dina Martina Christine, you know, would not fare well on Drag Race, but, you know, are incredible, legendary, amazing performers. And so I think for me, it was that thing where it was kind of like, I think it's best to not go on the show, but to be a fan of the show, admire the show, and work with people from the show. And that's worked out for me pretty okay.
That makes sense. Now, when you speak of Star Booty, you mentioned that it was a shit of a movie or whatever you just said.
It's fantastic garbage.
Well, then the fantastic garbage, that makes my segue into Showgirls.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. Like, because that was one of your inspirations for Midnight Mass. So Talk to me about Showgirls, your relationship with Showgirls, when you first, like, decided to choose that as subject matter.
Well, we booked it in the very first season of Midnight Mass, which was 1998. And in fact, it was so confusing to the film booker down in LA that they actually, when I asked for Showgirls, they booked the wrong title. They booked another movie from the same year called Striptease. With Demi Moore, which is sort of a forgotten film, but it did come out the same year that Showgirls came out. And so they called me back and I said, no, I want Showgirls, you know, the Verhoeven movie with Elizabeth Berkley. And they were like, why would you want that? I said, just trust me, just book it, you know? And so we booked it at Midnight Mass and we advertised free lap dances with every large popcorn. And you know, I made good on my promise. I booked all these hideous, monstrous performers to be the lap dancers, and the audience came in, and it was, you know, a sold out raucous wild rock concert of a show. And, you know, Nomi Malone kind of became our goddess. And then for the next 20 years, literally for 20 years, I had a massive Showgirls event every year in San Francisco, and then kind of took it on the road, you know. So it went to Seattle and New York and LA and some different places. But that was the show that was very much about celebrating that movie and our worship of the film.
I mean, so tell me about what you think of the movie. Did you love it? Is it crap? Is it brilliant?
Okay. So I think there's this idea. I describe it like this. There's a younger generation than mine. And maybe it's not even generational, but, like, people described films like Valley of the Dolls and Mommy Dearest and Showgirls as being bad. Now, I think there's this audience that would include me that never saw them as being bad. Like, I went to Showgirls. I saw Mommy Dearest for the first time. I saw Whatever Happened to Baby Jane for the first time, or Valley of the Dolls. And I did not think they were bad movies. I loved them. I wanted to see them again. Those over-the-top performances, those sort of larger-than-life camp performances that men are given awards for, you know, Al Pacino in Scarface, you know, he's amazing, he's brilliant, you know, Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs, he's genius, you know, but women, when women do it, it's considered trash, they embarrass themselves. Well, gay men of a certain mindset don't see it that way. We love Faye Dunaway and Mommy Dearest, earnestly. Mm-hmm. Earnestly love her. It's not this cynical hate watching that you find with cult movies like The Room, where people go and watch The Room and they love to hate it. They love how bad it is. They love how awkward it is, you know. And I find that to be a bit cynical, you know. For me, I actually want to screen Showgirls for an audience of 1,000 people at the Castro Theater who love Showgirls. And that's what it is. It really is. Now, is it bad in a conventional sense? Can we recognize what's awkward about it? What's over the top about it? Of course, but it doesn't matter to us. We still think it's fabulous, you know?
we still think it's fabulous, but do you think, like, okay, do you think that when they were making the movie that they knew it was bad? I mean, I know that's a dumb question. Do you think?
I'm lucky enough to have, you know, I'm so obsessed with Showgirls that, like, you know, when I screened it over the years, I was able to ask different people from the movie to come. So I've gotten to meet, you know, members of the crew, like the lead makeup designer, and pick her brain. Also Patrick Bristow, who plays Marty in the film, the dance instructor who yells, thrust it. Patrick, you know, was in Showgirls and is also in my film, All About Evil. And Patrick is, what's the word? He's just a really smart, generous, talented gay performer. I mean, he was openly gay. He was on the Ellen sitcom, you know, in the 90s as an openly gay man before Ellen came out, you know. And Patrick will tell you that on the set of that movie, they all thought they were making kind of an earnest expose of the life of a showgirl. But Verhoeven, when they would do a take, would kind of humiliate them and tell them they weren't acting enough to make it bigger. And for that thrust it scene, Patrick says, you know, he was so beaten down that he eventually just, you know, got on his knees and was slamming the floor and screaming thrust it at her vagina, almost as a fuck you to Verhoeven. Like, how big do you want it, bitch? You know, I can bake it big. And when he did that, Verhoeven was like, excellent. Bravo. You know, so Verhoeven and the script by Joe Esterhaus are responsible for this thing. And it was Elizabeth Berkley who was crucified for it unfairly, crucified, destroyed, humiliated, dragged through the ringer on the movie. But no, I think Verhoeven is a brilliant filmmaker. I think he's super talented. I think Joe Esterhaus is not a brilliant screenwriter. I think he's kind of a cheese ball and a misogynist. And I think that combination of this brilliant Dutch, you know, filmmaker making his version of a Hollywood movie, which worked so well in Basic Instinct and worked so well in, you know, Starship Troopers, it was the perfect combination, you know, with Showgirls for it to kind of blow up into this fantastic disaster.
Yeah, because, I mean, didn't they want it to be like, you know, like an expose on the life of a showgirl in Vegas? Like,
yeah,
serious ish.
And you know, if you're really interested in this, and actually even if you're not interested in it and you just like cinema and are interested in sort of how this all came to be, there's this amazing documentary that I was lucky enough to be asked to be in and part of called You Don't Know Me.
I was going to bring up. Yeah. So let's okay, talk yeah, about
so,
that.
So it's really genius because, I mean, I have to tell you, when I was asked to be in this film, I thought, okay, it's another project where a student's going to interview me and nothing's ever going to come from it, you know, which is like, probably 80% of the things that, you know, I'm asked to do, which is fine. It's all part of the process. You know, most movies that are attempted, I mean, when a movie is finished and it gets out into the world, you should applaud it no matter what, because so much work has gone into getting it out there. But this filmmaker, Jeffrey, he told me he was going to send me sound equipment and then call me on the phone. I was going to record my interview, not on camera, but on this fancy sound equipment and then send it back to him, FedEx. And that's how we did it. And then he asked for footage. So I sent him hard drives that he sent. No, he actually flew to San Francisco and met with my assistant. And he loaded up all this archival footage of Peach's shows onto a hard drive.
Okay.
And then years later, after honestly forgetting about it, you know, I get an email from him saying, it's premiering in Tribeca. And I'm like, what? How is it even a movie? You didn't even film us, you know? What are you talking about? Like, this thing that I thought was your grad student is premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it premiered there, and it got fantastic reviews, and then it's going on to have this huge festival tour. And what it is really is found footage. It's all the media clips, all the news clips of them talking about what their vision of Showgirls is. And then, you know, what actually happened and how it was destroyed by the press, destroyed by the critics. Elizabeth Berkley was destroyed. And then how little by little, people like myself, and other folks who really genuinely loved it have kind of given it this sort of second, third, fourth life.
So what was the, like, what was not the point, but like, what did they want to try to show with You Don't Know Me? Like,
I think what they do, and I love this, is it goes from a group of people basically in the first act saying, oh my God, this thing that's supposed to be this, you know, dramatic expose is a piece of shit. And that, and they actually put that on the thing. It's like, this is a piece of shit. And they go through all the ways that people think it's a piece of shit. Jeffrey brilliantly intercuts all of the films of Verhoeven to kind of show how Showgirls is similar to these other films, many of which are considered masterpieces. So then they go into the second act and talk about all the ways in which Showgirls is in fact a masterpiece. And audiences were clueless. They didn't get that it was a masterpiece. And here's all the ways it was a masterpiece. By the third act, they've infused all these ideas and declare it a masterpiece of shit. And, you know, that's kind of the scope of how the movie works. And I think by the end, I think the filmmaker and the story is just very compelling. And, you know, it nicely ends. Part of the ending is with Elizabeth, you know, being at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery screening where thousands of people showed up to see it. And, you know, looking gorgeous. I mean, just looking like $1 million. And decades later, this thing that was so painful for her, getting to, you know, introduce it and feel the love of the audience, you know. And Verhoeven comes off, I think, really cool in the film. You know, I think by the end of the movie, you go, okay, he's great. It's Esterhaus who you realize, like, really, he meant it. He wrote that script and he meant it.
Do you think You Don't Know Me, like, changed? I mean, like, I know it wasn't, like, worldwide. It was, but, like, do you think in a way it shed different light and changed people's perception on Showgirls? Or am I being too deep on this whole thing?
I don't know. You know, I think maybe I'm in too deep on the one side of it, right? So I think, you know, you probably need to ask people who had an indifferent opinion or maybe thought it was dumb or crappy to see if the movie maybe shifted their view. Ironically, there's another Showgirls documentary coming out that was being made at the same time as You Don't Know Me that I did shoot a video for, like a filmed interview. And that film, I think, will be a really great, I think it'll be a great movie to come out as well, because it's going to tell more of the actual behind the scenes story. Whereas You Don't Know Me is more of a critical analysis. This is more, how did this movie get made? What was it like working on the sets? They've interviewed, you know, the stars of the movie. They've interviewed Jeeta Gershon and Paul Verhoeven and, you know, Kyle MacLachlan. And that movie's called Goddess. So,
oh, wow. And yeah, when does that come out? That comes out.
I don't know, but it's the same director who did another movie I'm in called I Am Divine. His name is Jeffrey Schwartz. And he's done a documentary called Vito for HBO. And he's a really brilliant filmmaker. And so I'm glad that he's making this movie Goddess. And I'm glad that, you know, the saga of Showgirls will continue to kind of remain interesting and a mystery to people.
Have you ever talked to Elizabeth Berkley? I mean, like you said, like you think that she was unfairly trashed for all of this? Like, mm-hmm. And what do you think? Like, did this ruin her career? I mean, like, she has a career, but it derailed it. Like, what do you think about all that?
I think women are held to a different standard in Hollywood than men are. I think Faye Dunaway and Elizabeth Berkley were unfairly sort of crucified for the lack of success of those films, or for people thinking they went too far. And I do think Elizabeth's career, especially as a young woman, especially as this huge, big Hollywood feature comes out, it was really supposed to launch her career, you know, as a Julia Roberts. You know, she went from being a sitcom actor to starring in a multi-million dollar Hollywood blockbuster that really should have made her, you know, an Angelina Jolie or something, you know, along those lines. And so she has not had that career. and I think it's unfair. And I'm glad that she's still working. I mean, she was still, great in First Wives Club and, has done a book for girls. I think even that in some ways is Elizabeth saying, I'm not Nomi Malone. And yes, she has been invited to share the stage with me multiple times. And we've gotten very close multiple times, but it's never happened. And I would love to do a show with her. And I understand her reluctance. And, I think a lot of people, when they hear a drag queen named Peaches Christ is inviting you to come to screen a camp movie that they star in, there's this sense that I'm going to, how should I say it? Well, Maxwell Caulfield, who stars in Grease 2.
Which is a classic movie.
It's so good, so
classic.
Good.
And I'm sorry, I listen to that soundtrack at times. It's a good soundtrack.
It's a great soundtrack. It's totally underrated as a sequel.
Yeah.
And so when he came, we did the stage show together. He's so handsome. And yes. I remember doing the stage show at the Castro and interviewing Maxwell and him really kind of clamming up. And admittedly, me needing to kind of end the interview earlier than I would have naturally because it wasn't flowing. And he and I got upstairs and he apologized profusely, and I said, well, what, don't worry about it. It's fine. It was wonderful. I don't think the audience, but he and I knew that our chemistry was strange on stage and he kept apologizing. And I said, please don't. And he goes, I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm from England. Drag queens are cunts. And I went out on that stage with my battle armor on, ready to be humiliated and, torn to shreds by you. Here you are, this giant clown. And I sat down and you said the nicest things about me and put me on the pedestal and, channeled all this love from the audience. And he said, I went blank. I literally went blank because I was all prepared for a defense. And so I think there's this sense that I'm going to, if you haven't been to one of my shows or you haven't, and you only know the basics, you've seen pictures of me online licking a bloody knife or, whatever Peaches looks like. They get on stage and I'm like literally a kid, just saying, I love you so much. And let me ask you all these nerdy questions about the movie. And my job is to channel the love of the audience and to put them on a pedestal. Some people like Maxwell kind of, are, what's the word, thrown off by it. And my sense is if I were Elizabeth Berkley.
I'll admit it. As important as it is for me to eat healthy and put the right nutrients into my body and hydrate, I'm really not great at it. I'm always on the go. I'm never making that a priority, and I'm always hungry. This was a real problem until I discovered 310 Nutrition. I love 310 Nutrition's water hydrators. You just add them to water, and they make your water taste so much better. They also have refreshing lemonade mixes. My personal favorite, they're all-in-one shakes. I love their caramel sundae, their vanilla cake, the shamrock cream. I drink one of these shakes, and it totally satisfies my hunger. They're low in fat and low carbs, which I love. They also satisfy my carb craving. But don't take my word for it. Right now, 310 is celebrating a new year of goals with code VELVETROPE and giving our listeners 50% off up to $100 off your first order. With so many sample packs, new products, it's really fun and it's easy to put together an order or start a subscription on products you know you'll use. Go to 310nutrition.com and use the code VELVETROPE right now for 50% up to $100 for your first order. That's 310nutrition.com and use code VELVETROPE.
I might not know that my intentions are completely pure,
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Especially when you've been ridiculed for this for so long.
I mean, it's like, it's asking someone to, we wouldn't do this normally. It's asking someone to come and celebrate the thing that caused them to have PTSD. And that sounds dramatic, but of course it caused her to have trauma,
What about have you ever talked to her about she's not in on the joke. I don't think she knew when she was making this that it wasn't a good movie.
Yeah, no, she didn't. And she did you know, according, and I've done a bunch of shows with Rena Riffle, who plays Penny Hope in the movie. And, you know, I very much believe Rena and Patrick when they say that, you know, Verhoeven was asking for this level of performance. You know, it's not limited to just Elizabeth. She just happens to be the you know, the hero of the film, the star. So it's mm-hmm. most noticeable and ridiculous because you don't think of her as a protagonist. But they all say that Elizabeth was doing exactly what the director was asking her to do. You know, that the first take was usually very natural, you know, and, you know, he would work them up into a frenzy. So it sucks for her. I mean, it is also why the movie is amazing and you know, is still screened to this day and has documentaries made about it, and Striptease is totally forgotten. So, right. You know, I don't, you know, what, who knows, you know?
Do you think, like, I mean, what are your thoughts on Showgirls? Horrible shit, like classically shit, like you said, like we all love it as gay men at the very least.
Yeah, I think that Jeffrey's movie, You Don't Know Me, where Masterpiece of Shit is sort of the end conclusion. I completely agree with that. I think, you know, I love things that are considered bad, but there's the difference between bad and good bad. So, you know, bad to me is like boring, forgettable. Like, I'm in the movie theater and I'm distracted by the exit sign because I'm that bored. Like, to me, that's unforgivable, you know? Whereas Showgirls, yeah, sure, it might be bad in some ways, but you never get bored watching it. And, you know, it's always exciting and fabulous. And yeah, so it's hard for me to even just to call it bad. But again, you know, I also, you know, screen and do a show that celebrates Mommy Dearest, which is one of my favorite films that people think is terrible, you know. Yeah, I love those movies.
What other movies do you put, because you're a movie guy, what other movies do you put in the, like, Showgirls, Mommy Dearest category?
Let's see. Well, there's a lot that are lesser known, you know, that unfortunately, especially doing these big shows at the Castro Theater where, you know, I do two shows in one day and it's 1,400 seats, you know, I have to sell, so almost 3,000 seats. I have to do these more popular titles, you know, in order to sell tickets. But I sort of missed the days of Midnight Mass where, you know, I was in a 400 seat theater and people came just because we were doing a show, not necessarily because of the title. And so I was able to screen, you know, movies like Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, or Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. I think Beyond the Valley of the Dolls is another movie that people might write off as being a bad movie, but I would actually argue that it's brilliant and amazing and unlike anything you've seen. So yeah, I The Apple is another one. If you haven't seen The Apple, it's a musical about Adam and Eve, but done through a disco tale, and it's very much what people on the surface would call a bad movie, but I think it's fantastic.
And you liked Grease 2?
Love Grease 2. I love Grease 2. You know,
it was,
I think,
good.
Yeah, it's really good, you know, and again, another movie that people have written off as being bad. Teen Witch is another one. Teen Witch, you know, I've done a bunch at Midnight Mass, which, yeah, it is bad in some ways, but why are we watching top that, you know, the rap number on, you know, the internet millions of times? Because we like it. It entertained us, you know.
What about one of my favorites, Xanadu?
Well, I love Xanadu, and I've done Xanadu at Midnight Mass. That's one of the shows we did Drag Queen Roller Derby for. But we also had a whole pre-show, you know, celebrating the music for the movie. And then a musical artist who I love, Jer Bear Jones, sang her song Xanadu, which is about gay men loving Xanadu. So, and you're a Xanadu. That's what you are.
I am. And I mean, talk about the music. Like, I still listen to that, and I still listen to Grease 2 soundtrack all the time.
So good.
What about, I mean, do you watch reality TV at all?
Not as much as I used to. You know, we've got, we cut the cord on cable a while ago. So I tend to be unintentionally, I think, with less, scrolling, you know, my TV viewing has become much more intentional, not by design, kind of by accident. And I feel like I got into K-holes of reality TV more when I had cable and was flipping channels, whereas now I just haven't caught up with it.
I mean, because it is, to me, the same concept, you know, especially like Housewives is a big thing. That's like my thing. But you get into even worse, like 90 Day Fiancé, Love is Blind, Love After Lockup. You don't even need to watch these to understand. I could say Love After Lockup. You know what that is.
I will tell you, David, that I overheard, this is how tragic I am. I overheard some friends who admittedly have the trashiest taste. I mean, they love garbage. Like they intentionally eat at Olive Garden or whatever. And they love all the Housewives shows and they love all the, you know, and they were talking about 90 Day Fiancé in such a way that I had to go home and watch some of it just to see it, just to believe it. And I will say that I went down another K-hole of like, I could, you know, once I'm in one of those seasons, I need to see it all the way through. So yes, I have like, seen 90
Housewives
Day Fiancé.
Is one thing, but when you get to like 90 Day Fiancé and Love, it's the same concept. It's so bad that right. You just can't look away.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think it's you're drawing a very good parallel between some of our enjoyment of these films, and then we have to argue: well, is that bad television? You know. Someone's producing it. It's by design. You know, it's still storytelling. So,
and it's really highly rated. So,
yeah.
Is that bad TV if you're entertaining all of these people? Isn't that the point? No matter how bad it is.
I think it's exploitation. And I think that, you know, a lot of what I like is exploitation. I mean, you know, classically the word exploitation when it comes to like film and stuff would be inclusive of a movie like Showgirls or even Mommy Dearest, which is about child abuse for entertainment. And I think, you know, something like Real Housewives is a modern form of exploitation. And maybe there's a deliciousness in seeing these sort of rich Karens, you know, have drama and fight and, you know, we get to root for them and, you know, have our villains and, you know, it's a new kind of exploitation.
Because it is exploitation because the thing is you get a salary for the first year. It's not even that much money. I mean, if you factor in hair and makeup, it costs you money. And your second year salary is maybe you break even and like maybe the third year is when you see a little bit. But you could be fired at any time. So there's no, oh yeah, no, these casts change all the time. So there's a lot of people that last one season and you just didn't make it. Then there's other people, you know, 3 to 4 years, but it doesn't matter after 4 years, you're fired. And then even like 9 or 10 years. So it's like, it's exploitation in the sense that you're being paid to cause drama and have it spill over on social media and really double down on social media. And then when we're done with you, we're done. And you go from however many $100,000 a year to zero. And good luck. And I don't know, you're not going to go work at Bloomingdale's makeup counter when you're well known from a TV show. I don't know what you do after.
Right.
So to me, it's exploitation in the same sense.
Yeah. I mean, all of that stuff is designed, you know, I mean, it's kind of like Drag Race to sort of circle back. Like there are girls who have gone on that show and been able to launch massive careers. But of course they don't get, whatever they get paid to do Drag Race is negligible. You know,
nothing. It's nothing, yeah.
Right? So it's way less than they'd make if they didn't go on the show for those few months. But we all know that by going on the show, you have the opportunity to make so much money afterwards through the visibility you then have. But that's not what happens for everyone, right? There are girls who, you know, have literally retired from drag after going on that show in ways they may not have, you know, had they not gone on the show. So it's, you know, it's still a crapshoot.
Do you think that you have to go on Drag Race now, like as an up and coming baby drag to make it?
Well, I would say that it certainly helps. And that my advice to young drag queens aspiring to do drag in a post-Drag Race world is do not set your sights on getting on Drag Race because the odds are not in your favor. no matter how talented you are, there, you know, there are only so many people that will get on every year. And the tide, you know, with drag, this sort of oversaturation, or maybe I shouldn't say that, but yes, I think there is a sort of an over, there's a bit of fatigue. I'm a massive Drag Race fan, and even I can't keep up, you know, like, I can't watch, you know, the UK season and the Dutch season and the Thailand and, you know, now Canada and the All-Stars here. And, you know, it's so much that, like, just focus on making a fantastic career for yourself. And if Drag Race ends up being part of that, great. But if not, you know, that you have something to fall back on. Because, I mean, the likelihood of people getting on Drag Race now is very low.
Yeah. Three things before we wrap up, just things that I'm, so in addition, you also, which did the amazing Purple Rain and Apollonia was there.
Yeah, that was so,
I love Prince. So, and I mean, that's a movie, like, is that so bad it's good? Because to me, that's just good, that movie. Or is there a so bad part of it? I mean, I can see it.
There is. It's funny watching it. Because growing up, I loved, like you, I mean, Prince, I had all the same, you know, Cyndi Lauper. Like, we were so lucky in the 80s because
oh
pop stars. Oh, my God. That, like, not to sound like that bitter old queen, but come on. Like,
our music it's the best generation for music.
The best generation for music and style. Like yeah. you see the award shows from the 90s, 2000s. It's gotten more and more boring. And until Lady Gaga, you know, who's really doing something, you know, that's really a reference to David Bowie and Madonna and, you know, all of that. But, like, in the 80s, we had Cyndi Lauper, androgyny. You know, you had Annie Lennox doing the Eurythmics. You had George and Prince. I mean, even the heavy metal bands, you know, wore lots of makeup and stuff. So,
yeah,
you know, Prince was so one of a kind and so inspiring. But watching Purple Rain, you know, on repeat as an adult, I'm like, you know, some of it's a little like, oh God, this is a little problematic, right? But then they get into him doing, you know, Let's Go Crazy or whatever, and it is transformative. You know, you're at a Prince concert. It is so good. And Apollonia is quite good in it, you know.
She is.
Yeah.
So she came to the screening, and she was she a good sport? Was she just
the best? And she's someone that I've stayed friendly with because, she's just so lovely and sweet. And what's interesting about Apollonia, because one thing a lot of the Prince women have in common, the sort of the girls of Prince, is that they got into trouble later and found Jesus and, you know, and I basically asked Apollonia, like, why wasn't that your story, you know, Vanity and Sheila E. And, you know, we have, you know, a lot of women and she said, well, the difference really is that I was created to look like a Prince protege, but I was an actress who was brought in for an audition because when they wrote the movie, Vanity was supposed to play the part. She and Prince had drama. They needed to replace her quickly. And so they brought in a real actress. So Apollonia, even Apollonia 6, the creation of the band and the music and Sex Shooter and all that, she was like, for me, it was all part of an acting gig. So I never got emotionally invested in it. And Prince never, you know, used any of, like, we had a very business type relationship and a friendship. And so they always remained close. They never had a falling out. They never had drama, you know, things that are very normal or traditional with his other girlfriends.
Yeah.
Because they were never romantically actually involved at all.
But there's something maybe just like Showgirls and Elizabeth Berkley where you're kind of just Apollonia then. And
that's true.
I mean, like, what if you go for a TV show on ABC, you're seen as Apollonia.
Well, she did do, I think it was Dynasty. She did.
Really? You know,
she did act. Yeah, she did act. And it was as her full name, Apollonia Cotero.
Yeah.
And so she did these bits. But what she said, which I think is interesting, and I've met other Hollywood folks who maybe didn't go through as much drama, is that she willingly left the industry and was interested in leaving, and she married well. You know, she married a producer. She has a beautiful home in Hawaii, and she, you know, was able to kind of disappear and actually focus on her just, I think, happiness. And so when you meet her, she's like, as someone, you know, a lot of Hollywood people, you know that there's a certain damage that can, you know, come along with show business. I'll say that Apollonia doesn't carry that baggage. She's very normal. Good. Yeah.
That's good. And, you know, I think there's a misperception, like people think if you're in a movie or on a TV show that you're filthy rich, marrying a big producer is a better way to go if you want a financial statement. Yes. There's Taylor Swift and there's Lady Gaga. Yes. And there are exceptions, like, you know, Jennifer Lopez, but that's not the average working person that goes from TV show to TV show.
Right.
So I get it. What about your take on when you did the behind the scenes for Midnight Mass and you did the kind of like truth or dare Madonna-esque?
Oh, yes.
I forgot what you called that.
Spin the bottle.
Yes, Spin the bottle. It was like your dragumentary where you kind of did the behind the scenes for the Midnight Mass and it was based on Madonna's Truth or Dare.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a film that was made for our stage show when we did Sing Along Truth or Dare, which we did a bunch of times. And so that film played as part of the event. And so we put it on YouTube so long ago that it was when YouTube only supported 10-minute videos. So we had to put it in chunks, you know, because, you know, it was like, YouTube was brand new. So yes, that is very dated. It's very of that time, you know. There's like an Osama bin Laden reference and, you know, some other stuff in there.
Well, that's the thing. Speaking of Prince and Madonna, I mean, Prince, you could take it worse. You could do like Under the Cherry Moon or Graffiti Bridge.
Right, that's true.
And Madonna, I mean, who's that girl in Shanghai Surprise?
And the best of all, Body of Evidence.
Body of Evidence, yes.
Which has to be seen to be believed in terms of its badness. And right. I actually think it's bad enough that it's enjoyable. But Truth or Dare, for me, is a brilliant.
Brilliant.
Like, genius film of an artist at work, completely manipulated and completely produced, but so well done. And, you know, as a queer man of a certain age, I want to wring the necks of young queers when they don't understand the power of Madonna and say to them, this is a woman who at the height of her career, you know, when AIDS was ravaging the world and homophobia was at its height, you know, and people hated gays and they especially hated flamboyant gays and they really didn't want anything to do with gay men of color. She not only put them on stage with her, but she took them on talk shows. She put them in commercials. She brought, you know, flamboyant gay men of color to the forefront of a pop movement. And for that, you know, I think she deserves all trophies and prizes. Now, is she flawless? Of course not. She's ridiculous right now. But she's still a goddess and deserves our respect.
Do you think, like, do you still follow her on social media these days?
Yes.
Like, do you think Madonna has lost her mind?
Yes. And, you know, I think that there's this sort of level of celebrity that one reaches where you kind of leave the planet in a way and you're mm-hmm. living on this other planet. And I think she's been living on planet Madonna for so long. You know, I mean, to her credit, she had this vision of becoming Madonna, the Madonna we all know and love, and she became that Madonna. And then I think being that Madonna now for decades is bound to warp your, you know, ability to stay in touch with normal people. And clearly she's out of touch. And I think, you know, I love Oprah Winfrey. I grew up watching Oprah Winfrey. Being from Maryland, you know, Oprah was a hometown hero. She was, you know, and Oprah built a career on being relatable, you know. And now she lives on planet Oprah. I think it just happens, you know, where people, it's impossible for them to stay in touch. So poor Madonna just has no idea, you know, how she's coming off. And I actually, you know, still love her. And I went to the Madame X tour with my partner and I really enjoyed it. But I'll say that her inability to see herself, to be self-aware, is her biggest crutch. And I think that she doesn't what's sad to me is I still see so much of what she does and says is coming from a place of insecurity, and she's Madonna. You know, it's like, you're Madonna. You could just relax and have fun and be fierce. You don't have to, like, everything is so calculated and overanalyzed.
Right. I would agree with all of that, yeah. Which is, I think at one point she was very self-aware of things. Like, that's her whole career. That's why she was so great.
That was the secret. Like, same thing with Oprah, like, very in touch. Madonna totally was of the, like, nightclub, right, people.
And like, she went left, she knew she was going left. So it was all calculated.
Yeah.
She was aware of it, like, in on the joke. And I'm not sure that she is anymore.
No, and I cannot wait to see this biographical movie that she's making of herself.
It's going to be interesting. And I agree with you. I liked Madam X as a show more than I ever thought I would. I didn't think I would. But also then, it's also interesting because she has always been kind of self-aware, but never with the acting. Like, she never realized, being a good actress or not, like, what goes through your mind when you read, like, Body of Evidence or, like, a Shanghai Surprise, and you're like, this is it. I'm serious now. Like, how, I don't know. I mean, I've always wondered that. I mean, same thing with Elizabeth Berkley. Like, I don't know how you read a script and not realize, or maybe someone like Elizabeth Berkley just says, ka-ching, ka-ching, I don't give a
fuck. I think with Elizabeth, she was so young. I forget she was very young, coming off the Saved by the Bell show, and probably when agents and managers realized the same duo that brought us Basic Instinct were making a new movie, like, no one gave a shit about the script, right? It was like, who cares? You know, just sign on the dotted line. Whereas with Madonna, it's more baffling because she was already a pop star. She did have everything to lose. And she clearly wanted to be a movie star so badly that she kept showing up over and over again. I mean, not always, you know, was it a disaster, you know, with Evita and maybe Dick Tracy. But nor was she Lady Gaga in A Star Is Born, right? Like, she never got that's what she wanted. You know, that's probably why Lady Gaga drives her nuts. You know, it's like, not only can Lady Gaga sing really well, she also can act, and now she's won an Emmy. You know that, like, Madonna would murder Lady Gaga if she could.
Yeah, and it's just like, no, I mean, yes, and it's just like, you look at, and this is such, like, a stereotypical thing to say based on her age, but you look, it's true, you look at, like, a Tina Turner, a Diana Ross, Cher has done it right. Like, just, it's not even, like, act your age, because I don't believe in age shaming. It's just, like you said, you're Madonna. So just own the fact that, like, it's your world. We just live in it. And you don't have to prove anymore with pink hair or whatever. And if she really loved all of that, more power to you. But I agree with you. I don't think you do. I think it's all to stay relevant in some worlds.
Yeah, where absolutely.
You are relevant. What about, before we wrap up, speaking of Saved by the Bell, did you watch the reboot? Like, are you an Elizabeth Berkley fan outside of Showgirls? Did you go down the Saved by the Bell rabbit hole the first time around and the reboot?
I did not. So I think I was a little too old for Saved by the Bell, like, in its first incarnation. So I never really, I don't have a nostalgia for it. So I have not watched the reboot.
Well, it's good.
Is it good? Okay, well, I'll have to check it out.
I mean, like, but I like it all. Like, 90210, I watched Melrose when it came back on, like, all of that stuff.
Okay, yeah.
So what's next for you? You're in quarantine. Tell us what else is going on before we say goodbye.
Sure. So one of the things we're doing to keep Peaches Christ Productions afloat, since we can't be on stage, is we're pulling out old shows from the archives and doing live streams of them, where myself and the stars will host a live stream presentation of the show and do an audience Q&A. So this coming weekend, Bianca Del Rio and I will do our Whatever Happened to Bianca Del Rio show. So I'm looking forward to that. And actually, Bianca's texting me as we're talking right now. So it's funny, I'm getting these text messages flashing up on the screen. And I'm looking forward to it because I think there some shows, actually, speaking of Madonna, what we're going to talk about as part of the live stream is when Bianca and I did this show as part of the Feud premiere in Los Angeles. And we were told that someone was going to come in and help direct the show. And we were saying, but we've already directed it. It's already a finished show. Like, we're just, we're presenting the show we've already done. Well, we still, this person's going to come and meet you. And it was, without giving too much away, a very famous pop star's brother who did the Blonde Ambition tour, who has the last name Ciccone and the first name Christopher. I don't want to give it away who it is.
Right. But someone who wrote a whole book and all.
Yes. And it was an experience. And I'm going to get Bianca to tell, you know, the story of one of the rehearsals where the shit hit the fan. You know, so I think this show will be fun because there's some good behind the scenes, you know, gossip shit.
You had me at Christopher Ciccone. So that's all I need to know.
It's a mess. And yeah, so I'm doing that. And then the other thing is I have just used this COVID time to develop a bunch of new projects. So Varla and I have a pilot that we've written. A pitch it's going out for a TV series.
Wow.
And yeah, I'm excited about that. And then I'm working on a couple feature screenplays and, you know, just kind of after performing so much for so long, you know, being on tour, which I loved, but it was very hard to like write another movie or create a TV series, you know, because I was on stage or whatever. So I've been using the time for that sort of thing.
That's good. So you'll have to come back on and tell us about the developments of all these things that
play out. Absolutely.
Well, listen, I appreciate you staying with us for this long, first of all.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for talking about an array of things that were on my mind. Where can everyone find you online?
Just basically all the social media stuff. So, you know, I'm lucky enough that I've been validated. So I have blue check marks on Twitter and
that's official.
Yeah. And Instagram and Facebook. So you can follow me there. And then for the Bianca show that we're doing, it's peacheschrist.live.
And on Instagram, you're just Peaches Christ.
Yes. The Peaches Christ. Yeah.
So everyone needs to follow the Peaches Christ.
Because someone took Peaches Christ.
You know, well, listen, you have the blue check and that's all that counts.
Exactly.
That's just how it works. Yeah. Thank you so much. I will be watching that and everyone needs to stay in touch. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
Take care.
All right. You too.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to yet another episode of Behind the Velvet Rope. Because without you listeners, I would just be a crazy person with voices in my head. And if you like what you hear, subscribe on Apple Podcasts under Behind the Velvet Rope. And when you're done subscribing, feel free to leave a 5-star write-up review because the write-up reviews actually count. We read each and every one of them. We post the best ones and the reviews really help our shows keep going. And we really appreciate everything you guys say, especially the positive ones. And if you want to find us online, we're at Behind Velvet Rope on Instagram. We are at David Yontef on Instagram. We're Behind the Velvet Rope on Apple Podcasts. Or head on over to Patreon, because you know what? There are just some things we can't talk about here. So for our bonus episodes, go to Patreon and type in Behind the Velvet Rope. And if you still aren't sick of me and you want more David, go to Cameo and book me on Cameo. And you can ask me anything there. I'll answer whatever you want. And I have a bargain basement price of $10. Thank you guys. See you soon.